Kurki Jai. Pram Shikoshi Kapate Tanya Prabhu Nityananda Shiva Jinana Shivasali Gora Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopapina Shamakunda Radha Kunda Gidi Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Abhaji Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Ganga Maitunan Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Kunda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Krishnaya Bhujale Srinivati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Namami Namaste Saraswati Guru. Gauravani Pachani Mavisvasi Sinirani Paskatavi Satani Vande Nam Sri Guru Pumita Paikamam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Chat. Shri Rupam Sarvajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Sansajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaitam Parijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahadana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah Panchakalpa Chukhishcha Kripasindhavi Evicha Patitunam Padamayam Vajra Vitam Namo Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto 9, Chapter 9, the Dynasty of Ansuman, Text 9 through 12, so maybe 9, 10, 11, 12, something. Translation: when King Bhagirath approached Lord Shiva and requested him to sustain the forceful waves of the Ganges, Lord Shiva accepted the proposal by saying, "Let it be so." Then, with great attention, he sustained the Ganges on his head. For the water of the Ganges is purifying, having emanated from the toes of Lord Vishnu. Text 10. The great and saintly King Bhagirata brought the Ganges, which can deliver all the fallen souls, to that place on earth where the bodies of his forefathers lay burnt to ashes. Text 11. Bhagirata mounted a swift chariot and drove before Mother Ganges, who followed him, purifying many countries, until they reached the ashes of Bhagirata's forefathers, the sons of Sagara, who were thus sprinkled with water from the Ganges. Text 12. Yajjala sparsamatrena
Yajjala sparsamatrena
Mamadanda hata api
Mamadanda hata api
Sagaratma jadivan jagmu
Sagaratma jadivan jagmu
Kevalam deha basmabhi
Kevalam deha basmabhi
Yajjala
sparsamatrena
Ramadanda
Hatabi
Ramadanda
Hatabi
Sakra
Raja Divam
Yajjala Sparsamatena
Yajjala Sparsamatena
Ramadanda Hatabi
Ramadanda Hatabi
Sakaratmaja Divam Jagmo
Sagaratmaja Divam Jagmo
Kevalam Deha Vasmabhi
Kevalam Deha Vasmabhi
Yashchala Sparsha Matrena
Yashchala Sparsha Matrena
Ramadanda Hatapi
Ramadanda Hatapi
Sagaratmaja Divam Jagmo
Sagaratmaja Divam Jagmo
Kevalam deha bhashmabhi
Kevalam deha bhashmabhi
Ladies.
Yajjala sparsha matrena
Yajjala sparsha matrena
Ramadanda hatabhi
Ramadanda hatabhi
Sagaratmaja divam jagmo
Sagaratmaja divam jagmo
Kevalam deha bhashmabhi
Kevalam deha bhashmabhi
By the remaining ashes of their burnt bodies. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Because the sons of Sagara Maharaj had offended a great personality, the heat of their bodies had increased, and they were burnt to ashes. But simply by being sprinkled with water from the Ganges, all of them became eligible to go to the heavenly planets. What then is to be said of those who use the water of Mother Ganges to worship her? Purport. Mother Ganges is worshipped by the water of the Ganges. A devotee takes a little water from the Ganges and offers it back to the Ganges. When the devotee takes the water, Mother Ganges does not lose anything, and when the water is offered back, Mother Ganges does not increase. But in this way, the worshipper of the Ganges is benefited. Similarly, a devotee offers the Lord Padram Pushpam Palam Toyam, a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, in great devotion. But everything, including the leaf, flower, fruit, and water, belongs to the Lord, and therefore there is nothing to renounce or to accept. One must simply take advantage of the bhakti process, because by following this process, one does not lose anything, but one gains the favor of the Supreme Person. Yat jala sparshama trena ramadanda hata api sagaratma jadivyam divyam jagmu kevalam deha vasmabhi. Because the sons of Sagara Maharaj had offended a great personality, the heat of their bodies had increased, and they were burnt to ashes. But simply by being sprinkled with water from the Ganges, all of them became eligible to go to the heavenly planets. What then is to be said of those who use the water of Mother Ganges to worship her? So these were the sons of Sagara. They had a mission for their father. It was a proper mission. It was their service to recover the sacrificial horse. So the mission, the aim was proper, but there was something wrong with their mood. They didn't have the right mentality. So when they found the horse in the ashram of Kapila, they felt very angry. Oh, now we have found the thief. A good example of imperfect senses. And because they had this mood toward Kapila, now we have found the thief, it burnt up their own bodies. They weren't able to hurt Kapila, they hurt only themselves. Brahma danda hata. So danda means, what's a danda?
Stick.
Stick, hata means to destroy, to kill. And Brahma here, in the word for word, Prabhupada is identifying Brahma as a self. And in the translation, he identifies it as a great personality. So ultimately, they were hurting themselves. And therefore, they suffered. And for a long time, they were not able to move forward. They weren't able to transmigrate. Their bodies were there in the form of ashes, and they were stuck for a very long time, several generations, until here Bhagirata was able to have the Ganges come and take them, and their soul and their subtle body was able to go to the heavenly planets. So this is very instructive, this Brahma Danda Hata. That Srila Prabhupada explained several times that we really cannot hurt anybody else. The only person we can hurt is ourselves. Even when we offend a great personality, really we are only hurting ourselves. And of course nobody can hurt us. So this is really basic Bhagavad Gita chapter 2. The soul cannot be harmed. It's not possible for anyone to harm us. Even in the sense of karma, it's not possible for anyone to do any harm to us that's not already decreed by our own karma. If that were true, then others would be more powerful than God. Isn't that correct? If someone could hurt me in a way that I wasn't destined to be hurt anyway, then that person would be able to be above the laws of the universe and to be above the laws of God. If somebody wants to harm me, at best they can be an agent of something I'm already due to receive. It's like if I've ordered something from some company, so various persons could be the agent to deliver it. But I'm the one who ordered it, I'm the one who paid for it. The person delivering it is simply incidental. I mean, I could thank the delivery man if he delivers something that I like, but the delivery man is not the cause of what comes to me. What's the cause of what comes to me? The living entity is responsible, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, for their own suffering and their own enjoyment. So whatever other people do to me, good or bad, I'm really doing to myself. And whatever I do to others, good or bad, frankly, I'm also doing to myself. Because if I do good to others, it comes back to me. And if I do harm to others, it comes back to me. And I can't really do good or harm to anybody other than their own destiny. I can't do good to you other than your destiny, and I can't do harm to you other than your destiny. I don't have that power. So everything that we're suffering or enjoying, we are creating that. We are creating that. They're thinking, I'm harming Kapila, but they're harming themselves. And because Kapila, of course, is an incarnation, but it's not he's not meant to be harmed, therefore he experiences no harm. And we have this experience also. Somebody may try to do good for us, and it may not work, yes? Yes? They may not be able to do it. Just like a couple days ago, some devotees wanted to do something for me. And we were going to meet them, and we got stuck in traffic. There wasn't even traffic. I mean, traffic doesn't even explain what we were in. In like 2.5 hours, I think we had moved 20 yards. We were surrounded by buses on all sides. In front, behind, on the sides, bus after. We were the only little car in all of these buses. We simply could not move. It was as if somebody had, you know, shackled us there. And we even estimated that if I got out of the car and took the tube and went there, that it would be too late to do anything and so forth. So although they wanted to offer something, I couldn't go and receive it. I was blocked. I couldn't get what they wanted to give me. And we have the example also of bad things. Somebody may want to hurt you, and it has no effect. Everybody has this experience. So I'm going to do this, and they just can't do anything. So whether or not somebody does good for us or whether or not somebody does ill for us, it's not in our hands. Right? We don't have the power to hurt or help anyone, nor does anyone have the power to help or hurt us. We are the architects of our own fortune. I was just hearing this morning. Prabhupada was talking about nectar devotion, and he's talking about the verse Brahmanya Bharate Kanya Bhagavanji Guru Krishna Prasadi Bhai Bhakti Bhakti Bija. Bhagavanji, what makes a soul fortunate enough to get bhakti? And he's saying what gives you fortune is a gift of sukriti, where you do unknowing service. But he says you're creating your own fortune. No one else is creating a fortune. He says man is the architect of his own fortune. So we are really, this is what we have the power to do. We are really the deciders of our own fortune, materially and spiritually. Materially and spiritually. We can say, well, it's the mercy of the devotees, it's the mercy of God, but that mercy is always available. It's always available. Just like the sunshine. The sun is shining on everybody on the planet. You know, you can decide to go out of your house or not. That's your choice. Right? We serve prasadam here at a particular time. You can choose to go and get it, or you can stay in your room. You know, but it's being made available. So the mercy is there. Krishna's mercy is actually always there for the living entity. Krishna never withdraws his mercy from the living entity. That's not possible. It's always there. Also, these lectures on nectar devotion, one of them, Prabhupada was saying that mercy is available 24 hours to everybody. It's just a question of whether or not we want to receive it. So we are the architects of our own fortune. We decide materially what modes of nature we want to be under, which then brings us our good and bad reactions. We decide how much we want to accept Krishna's mercy, how much we want to accept the instructions of Guru. And everything we give to others, we are really giving to ourselves. Just like here it's even saying, everything we give to God, we're really giving to ourselves. Yes? Just like the Ganges water is used to worship the Ganges, and Prabhupada's making the point here, the Ganges neither decreases nor increases. You benefit. So when we give Krishna flowers, as Prabhupada's giving that example here, Patram Pushpam Palantayam, when we're giving Krishna flowers, it's already his flowers. You know, it's already his flowers. We're not giving him something that's ours. I remember one time at an airport, I saw one woman rushing in front of me, and she dropped her credit cards on the floor. She didn't see it, and she just kept going, you know. So I jumped up, and I got there. I had to race, because she was racing. I had to race to the airport. But I'm giving her what's hers, yes? I'm not giving her something that's mine. I'm giving to her what's hers. And everything we're giving to Krishna, it's his. He's not benefiting. He's not harming. You know, if I so-called use the flower for myself, he hasn't lost anything. So really, everything I'm doing is doing for, I'm doing for myself. And here we have the reason why we should not become angry at others. Why we should not harm others. Why we should not be envious of others. Because when we do, we're really destroying ourselves. We're really destroying ourselves. And it's fascinating that we so much tend to blame others for our misfortune, and we so much tend to want to punish others for our misfortune. One devotee just a couple days ago here was explaining this to me so wonderfully. She said, when we do something wrong, we have a natural feeling of guilt and shame and remorse in our heart. There's some feeling of pain and difficulty. And when we feel that pain, instead of using that pain as an impetus to change, what we do is we blame somebody else in our environment. We lash out at somebody in our environment. Oh, you've done this and you've done that and you've done this. You know, it's the fault of the government, it's the fault of the temple authorities, it's the fault of my spouse, it's the fault of my mother, whatever. You know, and we're taking this pain that we feel inside and we're externalizing it. Or ultimately, it's the fault of God. It's the fault of God, it's the fault of another living entity, it's the fault of nature. And the materialistic person is constantly trying to punish and subdue nature, just like we read about in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I will defeat God, I will defeat other living entities, I will defeat nature, and then I will feel happy within. But they don't realize that all of the pain we are feeling within, we are causing ourselves by doing the wrong thing. It's just pretty much that simple. So if we want to be free from suffering, if we want to be free from suffering, we need to choose to be aligned with truth. It's such a simple thing. I mean, it's just so... it's not complicated. We have to choose to do the right thing. And when we do the right thing, we are happy. When we do the wrong thing, we are unhappy. And it is completely in our hands. And all of the pain and all of our suffering is due to doing the wrong thing. It's not anyone's fault. It's not God's fault. It's not any other jiva's fault. It's not nature's fault. It's not the fact that we're in the material world. It's not the fact that we're in Kali Yuga. It's nothing other than our own choice. And we're the ones, you know, burning up our own bodies, so to speak. We're the one lighting a fire in our own house. Although the connection for us is not obvious. You know, it seems to us that we're a victim. Just like Arjuna asked that, the Krishna, in the third chapter. He said, it seems that I'm a victim. It seems that I'm being forced against my will to do something wrong. It seems that my misfortune is coming to me against my will. Krishna says, no. It's your own desire to try to enjoy the world. It's your own lust. It's your own misalignment with truth. So when we become realigned with the truth, when we act again properly, then our suffering gradually decreases. Generally, it's gradual. Generally, it's gradual. Like if a person has taken some intoxicant and then they decide they want to stop taking and leave intoxicants. Usually it takes some time for the effect to wear off, isn't it? If you've been eating the wrong kind of food and you say, now I'm going to eat the right kind of food, usually takes some time for the effect to be out of your body. Isn't that a fact? It's generally not immediate. Prabhupada gives the example of a fan. You unplug the fan, but the blades, there's still some motion there. So it can be immediate, it's possible, but generally it's not like that. Generally one decides, I will align myself with the truth, I will do what's really in my best interest. Prabhupada talks about our real self-interest. And that is to give myself to Krishna, to give everything to Krishna, and to bathe myself in the water of the association of the devotees, like who are like the Ganges, who have come from the toe of the lotus feet of the Lord, who have been resting on the head of Lord Shiva. To take the association of those who are aligned with the truth. To hear from them, to serve them, to become like them. To be inspired by them. And like them, to give everything to the Lord instead of for myself. And that's really all. That's really the beginning, middle, and end of Krishna consciousness. My suffering is because I'm unaligned, and my happiness is because I am aligned, and this is my choice, and it's my choice at every moment. And anytime I become angry at others, or dissatisfied with others, or I blame others, then I am in illusion. All of my suffering is a little indicator light that I need to realign myself. That I am the one, Brahmadandahata. I am like taking a big danda, a big stick, and just beating myself on the head with it. And then complaining, you know, someone else is hurting me, someone else is hurting me, someone else is hurting me. And I have nothing more to say. So if there's any questions or comments, yes.
Is it a nice class, nice points raised? Is it that somebody has the karma to receive some punishment, and that someone else has karma to inflict pain upon, and it's just that we keep bumping into the...
Well, you, it's not exactly that you have the karma to inflict pain upon somebody. You may have been granted the right to do that, but you don't have to. Let's say that you harm me. I'm then allowed to harm you back, but I shouldn't. I'm given the opening to do that. But if I use that opening, then I will also have to suffer.
So your example of the postman comes to deliver, you've ordered something, but you know, sometimes they deliver it, they chug it at you, or sometimes they hand it and say, here you go. So are we allowed to kind of, okay, the actual object that comes may come, but are we not allowed to kind of have some feeling as to the exchange that's going on?
Well, of course we're allowed to have feelings. Jed Barrett had some feelings of distress when Maharaj Arjuna insulted him. There were some waves of distress in his mind. He didn't like being insulted. We're people. You know, we have feelings. We're not machines. Even Lord Varaha, when he was insulted by Hiranyaka, it said that he felt disturbed by the insulting words of the demon. So even the Lord, I mean, he has feelings also, Prabhupada explains in that purport. Krishna doesn't like it when he's insulted. We don't like it when we're insulted. That's natural. We're residents of the spiritual world where everybody respects one another. I mean, this, sometimes they insult each other out of playfulness. That's another thing. You know, Krishna, you're not really strong. You didn't really hold up Govardhan Hill. It was really Sudama. You know, and why are you bragging so much? I can defeat you in battle. So, you know. Or Mother Rohini says to Mother Yasoda, what's wrong with you? Why are you tying up Krishna by these trees and putting him in danger? You know, you're not a very good mother. And Mother Yasoda says to Nanda Maharaj, why did you let Krishna stay in Mathura? You're a hard-hearted father. And he says, no, you're a crazy woman. Krishna's right here. So, you know, anyway, but that's playful. But there's no disrespect. There's no disrespect. There's no malice. There's no... nobody's harming anyone. That's where we live. That's our atmosphere. like a fish is comfortable in the water, so we're comfortable and we function in an atmosphere of mutual respect and consideration and dignity. It's unnatural for us to be in a situation where people are harming and insulting one another. It's very uncomfortable for us. So, of course, we will have these feelings when somebody disappoints us, you know, when somebody upsets us or angers us. Of course we're going to have these feelings. But these feelings should be an indicator light that it means I'm out of my element. Not that this person is my enemy. If this person is doing some harm to me, then either they're acting as the agent of my own karma, or they're acting as the agent of Krishna's will if I'm not operating under the law of karma. So either way, why should I become angry at them? I'm the architect of my own karma, and Krishna is all benevolent. So I just a little indicator, oh, I'm in a foreign environment. You understand? I'm in a foreign environment. Just like I'm generally in foreign environments. I'm generally out of my own country. And it feels different, frankly. The cultures are different. And sometimes it's a little uncomfortable because the cultures are different. People function differently in different cultures. And when I go back, especially if I visit where I was brought up in New York, immediately I can relax. It's quite interesting. Because then I know that the way I communicate will be understood by others. That I'm less likely to be misunderstood. When I'm in foreign countries, I'm very likely to be misunderstood. So it's just some reminder I'm away from home. That distress is a reminder. I left my home, and I left my home. Krishna didn't throw me out. I left my home, and it can be an impetus for feelings of separation from Krishna, rather than an impetus to try to get vengeance or something against the other person. But if nobody wants to be the instrument of our bad karma, Krishna can arrange it without another instrument. He doesn't need a jiva to do it. If I'm destined to die a violent death, Krishna doesn't require another jiva to cooperate with that plan. But if there's some jiva that wants to kill me violently and is allowed that opening because of some karmic situation, they'll be allowed to do that. But they'll have to suffer for that, unless they're a bona fide agent of God. You know, if it's the government that does it, then they don't have to suffer for it. Is that clear?
What advice do you have in gaining the strength for that type of, say, tolerance or strength of character to be able to...
Practice. First, accept it theoretically. First, accept it as a theoretical truth that nobody can hurt me or benefit me. I'm the only one who can hurt or benefit myself. It's completely in my power. I'm the architect of my own fortune. So first accept that as a theoretical fact. Other people are just the agents of my fortune. Either they're agents deputed by Krishna directly or they're agents acting independently that Krishna is using because nobody can really act independently. Even the demon who wants to act independently, Krishna is using in his plan. And Krishna is my best friend. So if Krishna is allowing something to happen, it's because it's ultimately for my benefit. Who is there to be angry at? Who is there to be distressed at? Who is there to be angry at Jesus? And I have my little mantras, you know, Krishna's meeting all of my needs, Krishna's meeting all of my needs, Krishna's meeting all of my needs in his own wonderful way, in his own time. And if you don't like my mantra, you can say Krishna's mantra, Yoga Kshema Bhanyan. You know, Krishna says, Nir Yoga Kshema Abhavan in 245, why are you worried about things? Just be situated in the self. And I'll take care of you. Don't harm yourself. Be situated in the self. Rejoice in yourself. And then just practice that. Practice in these situations saying these mantras. Whatever I do to others, I really do to myself. Well, what do I want to do to myself? I want to do good for myself, so let me do good to others. And because this is Krishna's desire that we behave like this, how many times does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? We just read through the entire Bhagavad Gita yesterday in Leicester, start to finish. It would be interesting to count how many times Krishna says, be neutral to friends and enemies, be neutral in happiness and distress, see friends, enemies, and well-wishers with an equal mind. So because Krishna wants us to do that, therefore when you make any endeavor to do it, even a little endeavor, even a superficial endeavor, even without your heart, even without your realization, Krishna will help you. And he'll give you realization. You know, you can be furiously angry. I want to kill the guy. Okay. Let's see, I'm the architect of my own fortune. This person is just an agent. And Krishna's meeting all my needs. Krishna's meeting all my needs, and whatever I do, I'm doing myself. So let me, we're good for this other person. Okay, I wish you well. I wish you, not really, but I wish you well. I do. May you suffer. No, may you learn through joy. May you learn through joy. And then Krishna says, wow, thank you. And he helps you. And he gives you realization. And you start to feel it. And you say, wow, that is so much nicer. And he helps you. And then you think, oh, I'm so happy. I didn't write that email. I'm so happy I didn't complain to the authorities. I'm so happy I didn't go and yell at that person. I mean, these guys, they were just thinking like that. I didn't even think they said anything. They were just thinking, the thief. And their whole bodies blew up, in a flame. But Krishna will help you. You make the endeavor, and then, so many times we think, I'm going to wait until I'm a pure devotee, and then I'll act like that. So right now I'll act like a demon. All my enemies have been killed. My enemies in the future will be killed. I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. So right now I'll act like that because, after all, I'm very fallen. So I'll act like a fallen person. And someday when I magically become a pure devotee, then I'll just magically act nicely. But part of becoming a pure devotee is making an effort to please Krishna, yes? And Krishna says, this is what pleases me. So part of becoming a pure devotee is doing the things that please Krishna, even though in the beginning they feel artificial. That's what Vaidhi Bhakti means. Vaidhi Bhakti means it says it's not coming spontaneously. Vaidhi Bhakti means it says to do this in the scripture, and I accept it theoretically, so I do it because it says so, even though I don't feel like that. And then if you do it because it says so, even though you don't feel like that, you just accept it intellectually, then Krishna responds and he helps you, and then it starts coming spontaneously. Yes, isn't that our philosophy? Yes, is that correct? Did I get it right? Yes? Okay. Is that right? Yes,
sir. Just wondering about when we go around Tulsi Maharani, for example, says all karma is gone.
Yes.
Then what does that mean? Is that
so why do I still break my foot after I walked around Tulsi?
Yeah.
Why does someone still steal my money after I walked
around Tulsi? It depends. Maybe Tulsi Maharani forgives or Krishna forgives, does your karma go? Or is it just the potency is there?
The potency is there. This is very nicely explained in Nectar Devotion. It's in the chapter on the five most potent items of devotional service. I cannot remember the number. I'm sorry. Chapter where it says very clearly that these are not exaggerations. These things have that potency, and therefore for some people it will have that effect, but it's not true for everybody. That it depends a lot on your consciousness. Just like it's stated, in the Shastra, you take the Charanamrita one time, you follow the Rathiyatra card one time. And frankly, sometimes don't we have pretty amazing experiences from little things in Krishna consciousness? I think everyone here, yes? Who has had some amazing experience from some little thing in Krishna consciousness? Okay. So sometimes you just eat one bite of prasadam and you have an amazing experience, yes? You read one sentence in a purport. You look at the deities one time. You smell the flower offered to the Lord one time. You distribute one book. Sometimes you do some little thing and you get this huge reciprocation from Krishna. This huge, yes?
This does sound then maybe just does sound a little bit like an exaggeration, though,
So Prabhupada addresses that question, and he says these things are not exaggerations. The potency is there. The potency is there. It is possible. It is possible that just by walking around Tulsi, all of your sins are gone. That's possible. It's possible just an 11th of a second association. I mean, like we had our devotee Ananta Shanti, he met Prabhupada for 3 days in Russia, and he then started the whole movement in Russia. For a few hours of association with Srila Prabhupada. Practically speaking, nothing. And then he started the whole movement. Russia is a place where we're making so many devotees. So, you know, they would, in the Vidagdha Madhava by Rupa Goswami, and so what Radharani is saying, she doesn't know what amazing potency there is in these two syllables, Krishna. That when she says Krishna, then she wants millions of years and millions of tongues, and the holy name is dancing in the heart, and all the senses become inert. And a little later on in that same work, there's a discussion between some of the gopis. So there's one gopi from a rival camp, from Chandravali's camp, and she comes to deliver a message to Lalita. And then she says, I'm going to go back now. Please give me permission to go back now to Chandravali, who's singing songs about Krishna. I think it's Vishaka, who says, oh, it's so wonderful you can do that. And Padma says, well, why can't you do that? And Vishaka says, well, we're not so fortunate. And Padma says, well, why aren't you fortunate? And Vishaka says, well, Radharani can't say one syllable. How can she sing a song? As soon as she says one syllable, she becomes an ecstasy. So that means each syllable of the holy name has the potency to fill one with ecstasy. I was talking to one devotee in our movement about chanting, and he was saying like this. He says, actually, every syllable of the mantra, ha, re, ma, ma, Krishna, every syllable is filled with ecstasy. He said it gets to the point when you really get absorbed in your chanting that you find every sound of the world, because Krishna has so many names, and every syllable of every name is filled with ecstasy. So every syllable that anybody says, any sound, you call the phoneme, any phoneme that anybody says, is part of one of the names of Krishna, yes? And he was saying, you know, when you get to this point, any sound that you hear from anybody, of any word, that immediately you get filled with Krishna. And I thought, oh, that's what Krishna means when he says, I am the sound in ether. So that means all the sounds in ether have that ability. Ya, soda, not so ya, so, ya. Someone says soda. Oh, can you give me some soda? Faint. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering two things, actually. One is four devotees. Is it their karma, or is it Krishna, or is it both?
These are all the perennial questions, you know. You guys have been, you're asking all the questions that we get asked over and over and over again. Is it karma or Krishna or both? Well, karmani nirdhati kinti jabhakti bhavna. Yes, vindu gopamata vendra mahasu karma. Pandani rupa palabhajana bhavtanoti. Karmani nirdhati kinti jabhakti bhavna. So there's no karma for the devotee. The kings who were imprisoned by Jarasandar, they were arguing with Krishna through their messenger. They sent them a message to Krishna why he should deliver them. And they said, we don't know why we're suffering under Jarasandar. We shouldn't be suffering. Because we're your devotees, we have no karma. So we can't be suffering by our karma. And how could we be suffering by your will? Because you say, yidayidahi dharmasya glanya bhavati bharcha abhutinama dharmasya tadatmanam srujamyaham. Jarasandar imprisoning us is adharma, and you've come to destroy adharma. So how can there be any adharma? And yet we're suffering. And it's interesting that Krishna doesn't answer their philosophical accusation, really. It's not really a question, it's an accusation. He doesn't reply to it at all. He just says to the messenger, I'll go and deliver them. Give them the message and I'll deliver them. And then what's even more interesting is that Krishna doesn't deliver them instantly. It's not like with Vasudeva and Devaki where their chains were just gone. Of course, that was just temporary. But they looked and their chains were. It wasn't like that, that Krishna says to the messenger, they're delivered. And then the kings just all of a sudden, they look around and they're free. You know, the building's gone magically. And they just walk out. So Krishna's ready to go right away and deliver them. And then he's Narada who comes and says, Maharaj Yudhisthira wants to have the Rajasuya Yajna. And he wants you to come. And Krishna turns to Uddhava and says, well, what do I do? I just told the messenger of the kings I would deliver the kings, and now I'm being invited to the Rajasuya sacrifice. And Uddhava says, well, if you go to the Rajasuya sacrifice, part of the Rajasuya will be defeating all the kings. And you'll have to defeat Jarasandhara as part of going to the Rajasuya, so go to the Rajasuya. So Krishna tells the messenger, that's what I'm going to do, go tell the kings. So how much time went by before Krishna released the kings? So he had to go to Hastinapur, maybe they were in Indraprastha. They had to go there. So that's a lot of packing, huh? You know, if you want to go to India for a few months, does it take you, do you pack instantly? No. Even my packing's pretty quick because I just have one little suitcase. I already know what I'm going to put in it, so I can pack in 15 minutes, but still something. And he's got 16,108 queens, and each of them have 10 children. And then they all have their tutors, and then all of the, you know, the servants, the cooks, and the washermen, and everybody. You know, it was a big entourage that all had to get ready to go to Indraprastha. I would imagine it would have taken at least a week or two to get ready. And then they're traveling. It says the queens were traveling in palanquins. So palanquins means somebody's what? Walking. I was thinking, that's really inefficient. Because there's also chariots. There's chariots and there's carts, but there's palanquins. So that's a long time. You know, how long does it take to walk from Dwarka to Indraprastha? And then they had to have engineers go and make bridges, and they had to arrange for boats, and just imagine. Often they had to build boats, and then they'd have to camp various places. You know, probably talking of it. At least hundreds of thousands of people, if not even millions of people, traveling. And then they get there, and Maharaj Yudhisthira is receiving them, and he's entertaining them, and so forth. So how many months have gone by? Probably at least three, right? Is that a reasonable estimate? At least 3 months have gone by. And then there's a year where Maharaj Yudhisthira sends out the Pandavas all over the earth to advertise the Rajasuya. They come back after a year and say everybody has either surrendered immediately or after a fight except for Jarasandha. So it's at least a year and 3 months. Then they have to travel to Magadha. And then Bhima fights with Jarasandha for a month, which is also interesting because Krishna's right there and still it takes him a month. And then the kings are released. So about a year and a half. Between the time Krishna says, I'm coming, and the time they're released. Or what to speak of with the demigods when they go to Krishna and they say, you know, Kamsa's causing trouble, there's demons on the earth. Krishna says, you take birth first. So, you know, how old was Vasudeva when he married Devaki? He already had other wives. I don't think he'd be younger than like 25, yes? Probably not. So that's at least 26 years have gone by from the time Krishna tells the demigods, I'm coming, to the time Vasudeva and Devaki's married. Then Krishna's not the first child, he's the eighth child. That's another 8 years. You know, so then we're going up to 33 years have gone by. And then Krishna appears and he doesn't immediately kill Kamsa. He goes to Vrindavan for 11 or 16 years, depending on how you want to calculate that. So then that's at least 44 years. Between the time Krishna says to the demigods, I'm going to come and kill Kamsa, and the time that Kamsa is actually killed. So, the real question is, how do I see my suffering? How do I give meaning to my suffering? Because the main thing that we want to do, we as human beings want to do with our suffering, is we want to give it meaning. If we want to get down to the essence of the question, we don't mind suffering if it has a purpose, frankly. I mean, if if we can understand the purpose, we don't mind. In fact, we don't mind tremendous suffering if it has a purpose. Otherwise, nobody would volunteer for the military. I mean, human beings all over the planet volunteer for the military. The training is suffering. The training is intense suffering. The living conditions are suffering. The food is suffering. It's all suffering. And you're risking, you know, permanent damage to your body or death. And it's a very real risk. It's not a small risk. You're risking even long-term damage to your psychology. But it has meaning, at least to these people, yes? I did it for my country. I did it for freedom in the world. I did it to help people. And we're willing to voluntarily take on a tremendous amount of suffering if it has meaning. The difficulty we have with suffering is if we feel that it's undeserved or we feel that it has no purpose and no meaning. We're just suffering for no reason. So it's really a search to find the meaning in my suffering. So we're suffering ultimately because we rebelled against Krishna, whatever the details of it may be. I wouldn't be in a material body, I wouldn't be in the material world unless I was rebellious against Krishna. And that this material body is, in one sense, it's my parabdha karma. But if that was immediately destroyed the minute that I started bhakti, how would I finish my bhakti? The moment I start my bhakti, I'm not qualified to enter into Krishna's leelas. Generally speaking, yes? I still need training. How am I going to get training? I have to have a body. So ultimately, it's my responsibility, it's my karma, even though I'm no longer under the laws of karma. Even though it's not Durga Devi who's taking care of my case anymore. And even though it's not happening, you know, just under the laws, it's happening under Krishna's supervision. It's still really ultimately my responsibility. Something like, you know, if you become a drug addict or alcoholic and you go for treatment, the treatment is painful. But it's not the fault of the doctor, even though the doctor's administering. And you finish taking the intoxicant, but yet there's something residual that's due to your actions. As far as is Krishna doing it, for the devotees, it's part of leela. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Jagadharma very nicely explains that all of Krishna's leela is wonderful. And when the devotee feels that what they're doing is part of Krishna's leela, then they exult even in the suffering involved. So the devotee can see meaning in their suffering in two ways. One is in terms of karma, in a sense. That the reason I have any suffering in this world is due to my own foolishness. Is due to my own rebelliousness, is due to my own misalignment with the truth. And if we're honest, which is not such an easy thing to be, especially in Kali Yuga, but in general it's not very easy to be honest. But if we're honest, we will admit that even now at the present time, even though I've become a devotee, and even though I'm chanting, and even though I'm serving, I'm not fully in alignment with Krishna, yes? If we really look in our heart, if we're honest, that I'm still doing things, I haven't fully unplugged the fan, huh? I mean, for most of us, speaking for myself, I haven't fully unplugged. I haven't given up all of my envy towards Krishna. It's not like, oh, Krishna, I don't envy you anymore. So I'm still feeding into this. I mean, I can see practically that some of the specific things that happen to me, even in Krishna consciousness that are negative, I have specifically done something to bring that on myself. Well, we can often see this with others, yes? It's quite obvious with others. You'll see somebody suffering and you can see exactly what they did to do it. I mean, I remember some instance where devotee A falsely accused devotee B of a crime. And 3 years later, devotee B was falsely accused by devotee C of the same crime. You see it. I saw another instance where devotee A didn't protect devotee B. And years later, devotee C didn't protect devotee A. And then devotee A called up devotee B and said, I failed to protect you, and therefore I was not protected. Everybody knows of cases like this? Devotee A criticizes the authorities. Devotee A becomes an authority and gets criticized. we've all seen this. And with devotees, it seems to happen very fast. So if you put something out there, it tends to come back rather quickly. And that's not being managed by Durga and Indra and Amaraj. It's being managed directly by Krishna. But a lot of the meaning of our suffering is a mirror. You're doing this to somebody, and you're probably doing it now. You're probably not something you did 200 years ago, and now you're just as white as a little lamb. So that's one of the meanings. One of the meanings of our suffering is a mirror of what I'm doing now that's out of alignment with Krishna. That's evil, that's harmful. And another meaning to suffering is that we are part of Mahaprabhu's Leela. And that the so-called suffering then is just part of the story. There's no excitement in a story if there's not a problem. A boring story. Susie wakes up, brushes her teeth, combs her hair, goes to work, goes home, eats some dinner, goes to bed. Nobody's going to buy tickets to that movie. There's got to be a problem. There's got to be some story. Even in the spiritual world, Krishna creates problems. So if we change our consciousness to see I'm part of Krishna's story, then as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, the difficulties become great joy for us. Exactly, like we feel joy in difficulty when it's for some higher purpose. So a lot of the difficulties we face are like that. You know, people ask me all the time, what do I do with some relative, some family member who's impeding my Krishna consciousness? I said, you know, that happens to the gopis. The gopis get husbands and mothers-in-law that are impeding their going to see Krishna. It's not like you're going to get to the spiritual world and there's no story anymore. That's Brahman. So we can see the difficulties as, you know, this is some practice for entering into Krishna's Leela. How do I respond to this difficulty in terms of Krishna's will and in terms of Krishna's story? So those two ways we give our difficulty meaning. That our difficulty is a result of our own present, in the present tense, continuing to have actions, words, and mentality that are out of alignment. It's like, I give the example all the time. The architect builds this building, they build a door and a wall. And if I choose to walk into the wall, I suffer. It's not the fault of the architect or the builder. And even if I'm relieved of all of the reactions to my past sins, if I walk into the wall today, I get hurt today. It's not like Krishna's going to say, okay, you're my devotee, you can walk into walls and you won't get hurt. You know, if you're my devotee, but if you offend another devotee, you're still going to get some, there's going to be something coming back to you. Otherwise, how are you going to learn anything? And then the other is, how is this part of Krishna's plan? How is this part of Krishna's pastimes? How is this a way to depend on Krishna and say, Krishna, help! He likes that, you know. He very much likes that. And when we're in Krishna's pastimes, there'll be floods from Indra. There'll be demons. There'll be, you know, mothers-in-law who try to lock us in our house. I mean, all kinds of things. Is that okay? Yes?
I'm just wondering if someone is not, or someone not advanced enough to be able to say, you know, I wish you well, even though you're trying to kick the living crap out of me. Is there a point, and what is the point, where we can say, oi, stop, that's enough?
Well, you can do both. You can say stop and I wish you well, both. I wish you well doesn't mean I have to sit there and let you kick me.
That's what I mean, because
that's not a question of advancement or not advancement.
Yeah.
We have a duty to protect our body, we have a duty to protect our spiritual life, we have a duty to protect our mind. We don't have a duty to protect our ego, by the way, our false ego. we have a duty to destroy our false ego. But we have some duty. It's Krishna's body, it's Krishna's mind, it's our spirit. We have some duty to protect that. But still, we should wish everyone well and not see the person who's the so-called impediment as our enemy. There's no reason why it's not a choice. It's not, that wishing my enemy, as my so-called enemy, well means I have to continue to let people harm me. And it's not that some basic protection means I have to wish people ill. You can get basic protection. You don't have to, take your money and throw it all over the street in central London. It's Krishna's money. But you can wish the robbers well. What does it mean to wish somebody well? May you become Krishna conscious. May you be free from your anartas. May you be free from your evil in a wonderful way. May you be free from your evil without suffering. Wouldn't we like to be free from our own evil without suffering? Anybody want to learn their lessons through suffering? Who would like to learn all their lessons through suffering? Who would like to learn all their lessons joyfully? Who'd like to learn all their lessons joyfully? So wish that to your enemy, and then it'll be what bounces back to you. That's how the world works. If you wish your enemies, may they learn their lesson in the most painful, horrible way possible, then guess what bounces back to you? Okay, you get to learn your lessons in the most painful, horrible way possible. There you go. That's what Suniti says to Dhruva Maharaj. Whatever you wish for others comes back to you. May those who heard me learn their lesson in the most blissful, ecstatic way possible. May they never have to suffer to learn their lesson. And guess what comes back to you? You'll start learning your lessons in the most blissful, ecstatic way possible. And you don't have to be advanced. You just have to do it, and then you'll become advanced. Don't wait to become... don't wait to become advanced to act properly. How will you become advanced? What's going to make you advanced? Magic dust. It's going to make you advanced. We're going to become advanced by practicing sadhana bhakti. What is sadhana? What does vaidhi sadhana bhakti mean? It means I do the right thing because it says so in the scriptures and it says so from the gurus, even if I don't spontaneously feel that way. And isn't that supposed to lead to spontaneity? You don't just sit around your house waiting for spontaneity. If I wish my so-called enemies ill, waiting for this spontaneously, thinking they wish that, then I'll never become spontaneous. Do it because it's what we're supposed to do. And then Krishna will help you, and then the feeling will come. Because even doing it externally gives you so much happiness. Even if you're saying, I wish you well. I wish you well, Krishna. Please, please bless my enemy. Please bless my enemy. Please, yes, please bless my enemy. And then you'll say, oh, that's nicer. And then you do a little more and a little more. Yes, Ramon?
Me?
Yeah, did you have your hand up?
Pardon?
Did you have your hand up?
No, but I wanted to say something, but I didn't lift up my hand.
Oh, I just picked it up.
That's maybe you thought you felt it.
It must be.
We were mentioning about someone offending, etc. So I remember that reminded me of the story of Buddha, when he was insulted by someone. Then he asked this person. He said, "If someone offers you a gift and you don't want it, what do you then what do you do with it? Or I'll give it back." He says, "Then please keep your words of whatever to yourself."
I'm not accepting it. Yeah,
yeah, I'm not accepting it.
Very nice. There are some cases where the devotees do not defend themselves at all. Some cases. Prahlad didn't defend himself, but how could he? He was 5 years old. His father was running the universe. Defense was not an option, and he couldn't go to the police. His father was running the police. It just wasn't an option. There was no CPO. Haridas is another example. He was being beaten by the government. Where was he going to go? How was he going to defend himself? He couldn't. So you have, in those cases, the devotees just accepts, okay, I can't defend myself. Krishna, you can defend me if you want. Rai Krishna, Raki Kevamari, Raki Krishna, Raki, somebody we've been in Jiva Nimani, whatever you want to do. And then there's an example of Amarish Maharaj. Why didn't Amarish Maharaj defend himself against Javasa? Amarish was a king. He fought on the battlefield, I'm sure. He wasn't wimpy. I'm sure he wasn't wimpy. So why didn't he defend himself? Why was he just standing there with folded hands? He saw more results in what ways? As a sage, he saw Kshatriya and Durvasa as a Brahmana. And also Durvasa was his guest. So he saw Durvasa as my guest and he's a Brahmana. Therefore, even if he kills me, I'm not going to retaliate. And I'm not even going to defend myself. So there are certain instances where a devotee might not even defend themselves. You know, Amarish was just standing there. You want to kill me, you can kill me, Durvasa. Even though Amarish was in the right and Durvasa was in the wrong. But generally speaking, the devotee doesn't just stand there and let people rob them and beat them and insult them. And such. Yes? How do you know how to act in the right way at every moment? What does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? How do you know what's binding, what's liberating, what's to be done, and what's not to be done? You have to be in goodness. So Krishna says that understanding, which knows what is to be done, what is not to be done, what is binding, and what is liberating, is understanding in the mode of goodness. So when one comes to Satvaguna, one will always know what needs to be done. Therefore, it's always inside out. Don't ask what needs to be done. Get your consciousness in the right place, and you'll automatically know what needs to be done. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Adha Omala ki.